It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. How and why do we gain weight? And why do we struggle to lose it when we try to? Is it the decisions we make, our lifestyle, our genetics, our willpower, a little bit of everything? Those are questions that have puzzled countless people and motivated medical researchers, as well as pharmaceutical companies, to find answers. Now, new, stronger versions of anti-diabetic drugs are adding a new wrinkle and may help provide some solid explanations for what determines a person's weight and what can be done if weight becomes unhealthy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked with a medical provider on losing weight? Have you had experience with these drugs like Ozempic or Wegovy? Is treatment like that something you've considered for your own health? And what questions do you have about how these medications work, how they fit into issues of weight loss and diabetes? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Lisa Morselli is an assistant professor of medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's interested in weight management, diabetes, and general endocrinology. Her research includes looking at metabolic adaptation to weight loss. Dr. Morselli, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for having me.
These drugs like Ozempic that are getting a lot of attention as potential anti-obesity drugs, they came, I understand, as part of an anti-diabetes effort. Can you talk about the origins of these medications? What were they originally intended for?
Yes, so you're right. These drugs were initially developed for diabetes. And interestingly, the first compound was isolated from the saliva of a lizard, poisonous lizard that lives in Arizona. But this compound was found to have an effect on the pancreas, on the part of the pancreas that produces insulin, which is what's lacking or not being produced enough when people have diabetes. And so the first compound was developed in 2005. And then there's been newer compounds that have come out since then. And in addition to improving blood sugars, it was noted that they caused weight loss. And so that's why they've been used also for weight management.
I get, you know, limiting the pancreas's ability to produce insulin. I get why that would help with diabetes. Do we know why these medications are helping with weight loss?
Yes. So they are similar to a hormone that is produced in the gut that works on the pancreas to help with insulin production, but it also works on the centers that control appetite in the brain. And this hormone called GLP-1 or glucagon-like peptide 1 basically makes people less hungry. So that's how then these drugs cause weight loss. And so the effect is in part on the brain and in part by slowing down the emptying of the stomach, which is something that people may have heard in the news. But the main effect is really how it acts on the brain centers that control appetite and hunger.
I mentioned that your research includes looking at metabolic adaptation to weight loss. And I've read about this idea of a set point where whatever weight we might be at, our brains kind of say, okay, yeah, this is how much fat I want the body to have. This is the weight I want. And no matter how hard we try to go below that, if we're trying to, our brain is going to manage our appetite in a way to keep it there. Is that kind of what we're talking about when we talk about metabolic adaptations to when we lose weight?
It's kind of. So, yes. So you're correct that there's now this theory that our bodies want us to be at a certain weight. And that's determined in part by what happens in the brain, because the brain is what controls energy balance. So the balance of energy in and energy out, which is ultimately what defines our weight. And this concept of set point is probably why so many people gain weight and it's so hard to lose it. And we don't really know what's causing that, what's determining that. It's probably a combination of genetics and environmental factors. But metabolic adaptation is basically the response that the body puts into effect when we're trying to lose weight, to fight the weight loss and bring us back to where our body thinks we should be in terms of weight.
Talking to Dr. Lisa Morselli from the Medical College of Wisconsin, looking at our weight, how we manage it, how these new classes of drugs seem to help with weight loss, and who they're intended for. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Morselli, I understand you've worked with these medications for years now and with patients. Who would be the most likely candidate to take one of these medications with weight loss in mind?
So in general, we defined, we identify who should be on a weight loss medication based on body mass index, which is a rough measure of if you're overweight or not. The guidelines are that if a person has a BMI greater than 30, they can be on a weight loss medication. If they have a BMI greater than 27 and they have some complications due to excess weight, like, for example, diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol, then they also qualify for a weight loss drug. So in my practice, those are the guidelines that I follow. Definitely, these drugs should not be used for people who are not clearly overweight. And we know that there's been a lot of hype in the news and from Hollywood celebrities about these medications. And that has led to many people who maybe should not need a medication to lose weight to want to take them. But yes, if you have if you're clearly overweight and you have potentially complications from this overweight, that's when you qualify for a weight loss drug.
What are some of the health impacts of being overweight or obese?
Well, there are many health adverse health impacts, really. You can have diabetes, you can have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, heart attacks, strokes. You can have joint issues. You can have fatty liver. There's many types of cancers that have now been related to associated with obesity. So the health impact for many people is significant. There are some people who have obesity who don't have any of these issues, but they're really a minority. That's why we recommend weight loss.
Now, we saw an article in the Wall Street Journal. This is part of what made us interested in this conversation. They ran a piece with a headline saying it's biology over willpower. So the idea being that, okay, these drugs are showing that, hey, if you're struggling with your weight, it's not a failure of your willpower. It's something about your biology. What do you think about the role of willpower? I think we assume it can do a lot when it comes to our nutrition and our weight loss.
Obviously, to lose weight, you have to be in the right place and you have to want to lose weight. But I think that if losing weight was just a matter of putting some willpower into changing how you eat and exercising more, then everybody would be able to do that. And unfortunately, obesity and overweight are still viewed as poor lifestyle choices and character flaws by a lot of people. But in the medical community, in the scientific community, we've known for a long time that there's a lot of biology that drives weight. And in fact, the Obesity Society, which is our professional society, defined obesity as a chronic disease, so a chronic condition like diabetes or high blood pressure, already in 2008. So this is a new concept for the general public, that they're... weight gain is a matter, not just a matter of willpower, and that biology has a big role, but it's not really new for us obesity practitioners.
We're talking about what controls a person's weight and what new drugs could tell us about the causes of obesity. Dr. Lisa Morselli stays with us, assistant professor of medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about the biology of our weight, of our metabolism? Is healthy weight something you've struggled with yourself? Have you been able to find treatments, lifestyle changes, whatever it might be that worked for you? Are you curious about these drugs you may be seeing headlines about, billed as weight loss medications. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Dr. Lisa Morselli, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin, talking about what causes people to gain weight and struggle to lose weight if they want to, and what stronger versions of a class of drugs are teaching us about how our metabolisms work. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Jennifer is with us in St. Paul. Jennifer, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jennifer?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things, the medications that are prescribed and obtained through a compounding facility, or then you get them through the mail versus you're going through the regular clinic and family practice channels. It seems to me like I'm hearing about some of the ladies going to like a medical concierge versus being able to go to their family practice. It's cheaper. And what your thoughts are on that when you just get it delivered to your mail versus through like your local pharmacist.
Thanks for the call, Jennifer. I understand, Dr. Morselli, some of these compounding pharmacies are working with some of the medications we're talking about. I haven't read much about this, but the FDA has given some warnings against turning to some of these drugs. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. I agree with the FDA. The issue with these compounded medications is that we don't really know where they come from. These medications are still under patent, and so there's a concern that maybe the compounds that are used, the drugs that are used to make these medications, are maybe research grade compounds, or they are not. Yes, they are produced in compounding pharmacies, so the safety guidelines should be followed in the preparation, but it's really unclear where these drugs come from, and that's why it's not recommended to turn to that source.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for the call. And Dr. Morselli, as I understand it, a lot of these medications we're talking about, it's not a bottle of pills you take home. These are injections you would receive at a doctor's office in many cases. Can you talk about how we take these medications, how often we have to do it?
So these are injectable drugs. Some are daily injections under the skin, and they come in a pen device, so you don't need to go to your doctors. You can give it to yourself. The newer versions are weekly injections, so you just take them once a week, but it's still a injection under the skin.
And for people who use these medications, for that person who's overweight or obese, has success with these, what happens when they stop, if they stop taking these medications?
Yes, so that's also something that many people don't realize, is that if you start a medication for weight loss, these injectables or other weight loss medications, if they help you by helping you eating less and controlling your appetite, it's not that once you stop taking the drug, things stay the same. Things will go back to where you were before. So your appetite will be revved up, and it will be hard to continue to control your portions and eat reasonable, portions. So these drugs have to be taken long term. And it's not that, you're going to continue to lose weight indefinitely. At some point, things will balance out because, again, the human body has a lot of mechanisms to prevent excessive weight loss. But when we try to lose weight just with diet and exercise, these mechanisms kick in pretty fast. And these drugs overcome these mechanisms for a while, which is why they allow, they help us lose larger amount of weight than just we would achieve with just diet and exercise.
Let's go back to our callers.
They have to be taken long term. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Nicolette is with us in Appleton. Nicolette, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question for Dr. Marcelli is in regards to my specific situation. I've been intrigued by the drugs and, caught off guard a little bit by some of the comments made and observations with celebrities. So I was glad that you touched on that. I've always felt like after my last child that I just had, it's been really hard to come back, and I'm not seeing the same results as easily as I did with my other children. I ended up, it's been about 8 months now, and I've been curious about asking more about these drugs because I feel like nothing is working for me, and I'm working very hard at it, to the point where I feel like I'm almost hurting my body more working physically at it, than I ever have before. So I was curious if, post-baby delivery bodies and mothers, if that's like a consideration or a testing that has been looked at and something that I could look into with a doctor.
Nicolette, thanks for the call. And Dr. Marcelli, of course, I won't ask you to diagnose Nicolette in particular or suggest medications or not, but how to evaluate a situation if a patient comes in and says, post-baby weight is Ozempic or Wegovy or one of these medications maybe the right path? What kind of things would you do to evaluate that?
Well, the first thing I would look at is what the person's BMI is, because that's really, these drugs are approved for a certain BMI, and BMI is the body mass index. It's basically a ratio of weight to height, that helps us assess if a person is overweight or not. It's not a perfect measure, but that's what we use in clinical practice. And so that would be the first thing that I would look at. And then I would also try to see if there's other factors that can contribute to difficulty losing weight. There's definitely, sleep deprivation is a has a big influence on our weight status. Medications, I would definitely review the person's eating habits and exercise habits, but we need to do a comprehensive evaluation. So definitely your caller should talk with their doctor to see if one of these medications is appropriate, with the idea that this would not be temporary fix. It would probably have to be a long-term medication.
Nicolette, thanks a lot for the call. Talking to Dr. Lisa Marcelli from the Medical College of Wisconsin about weight loss, and the drugs you may have been seeing headlines about. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Marcelli, can you talk about the kinds of side effects we might see with these classes of medications?
Yes. So the most common side effects that we see are gastrointestinal side effects. So because the initially, especially these drugs do slow down the emptying of the stomach and also how the gut moves. So many people struggle with constipation. It's usually not, it's not a intractable constipation. So if you make sure that you have enough fiber, you drink plenty of water, usually things improve. And then you can have the opposite problem also from constipation. You can have nausea, and then reactions at the injection site, so rash or itching. That is also something that we see. These are the main side effects. And then these drugs can also raise the heart rate. So for most people, that's not an issue, but if you already have a high heart rate to begin with, or if you have some abnormal heart rhythms, those can become worse with these drugs. So that's why it's always good to consult a doctor before starting this type of medications.
And Dr. Marcelli, I've read at least anecdotal accounts of patients saying, who are obese, they're using one of these medications. They've been one of the more successful stories, and maybe they're able to stop taking a blood pressure medication or go with a lower dose cholesterol medication. Is that a benefit, a potential trade-off, even if we worry about some of these side effects?
Absolutely. So the idea of losing weight, it's not just for cosmetic reasons. It should be done for health reasons. And we know, as we mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that excess weight has a lot of consequences on our health. And so definitely any weight loss will make you healthier. But obviously, the more you lose, the more you may be able to shed some of these medications for these conditions that are associated with excess weight. So definitely that's one of the benefits. And I will say that the great majority of people does tolerate these medications well.
Dr. Morselli, in just our last minute or so, you've been working on these issues for some time now. Big picture, how big a deal are these medications? How much does this change the face of weight loss?
Oh, they're a huge deal. Because, you know, so when we talk about weight loss, obviously everybody starts from a different weight. So to kind of standardize things, we talk in terms of percentage of weight loss. And in the past, we considered that a weight loss that would make you significantly healthier is a 5% weight loss. Now with these drugs, many people achieve a 15 or even a 20% weight loss. So we're talking about, you know, extent of weight loss that we had never seen before with older weight loss drugs. And for some people, this is close to what weight loss surgery would achieve. So that's really, those are really game changers.
Dr. Morselli, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That's Dr. Lisa Morselli, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We talked to her about what contributes to excessive weight gain and obesity, how new weight loss and anti-diabetic drugs are telling us about the body's processes around weight and metabolism. I'm Rob Ferret. Check out these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. A new United Nations-backed report highlights the massive destruction caused by invasive species on a global scale. The report was published by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. It looked at over 3,500 invasive species across the world. It estimates that invasive species cost society $423 billion every year. Invasive species also cause about 60% of extinctions. They're so widespread, they've even made it to Antarctica, where invasive grasses have been introduced. Our next guests are experts on invasive species here in Wisconsin and beyond. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you run into some invasive species in Wisconsin? Are you battling one of them maybe on your own property? Or do you have questions about the impact here in the state and elsewhere? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. Brad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. She served as an advisor on invasive species and climate change to the National Science Foundation. Carol, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've got this big international report. Carol, can you help us understand the scale of the invasive species problem?
Well, the scale is enormous, as the report says. Invasive populations are causing huge economic costs. For example, according to the World Health Organization's Guide to Ship Sanitation, about 10 billion metric tons of ballast water are transported through ship traffic every year. This is incredibly costly. I work on aquatic invasions, and the scale is just incredibly enormous. We're talking about billions and billions of tons of water moved throughout the year, causing large numbers of invasive populations to enter novel habitats. That's just one example.
Brad, people might wonder, you know, species have moved around through the millennia, you know, it moving into new environments all the time. why are things different now? What is it about our current invasive species situation that makes it so easy to throw things out of whack?
Right. That's a good point. And, you know, we're in a time of globalization where it's very easy to move around the world. And, you know, at times we either on purpose or inadvertently move species with us. And they're moving in ways that they would never be able to move on their own. So crossing oceans and, like you mentioned, grasses getting to the Arctic. And so the scale is much larger and happening much quicker than it would just, you know, in a natural way.
Carol, Brad mentioned sometimes intentionally spread things like horticulture, exotic pets also contribute to the problem. I believe we used to plant purple loosestrife, for example, in Wisconsin.
Yes.
On purpose. We don't do that
Yes.
anymore, I hope. How big a part
Right.
of the story is that?
That's a huge part. I think the horticulture industry, the pet industry, the aquarium industry are pretty large contributors. So the biggest factor that correlates with the rate of invasions is our trade volume in general, shipping trade, cargo trade, et cetera. But definitely the garden, I think we need to fundamentally change how we garden and plant native species. So the horticulture industry, the pet industry, the aquarium industry, people releasing invasive plants in their gardens, releasing aquarium fish into lakes, such as the African cichlids in Florida. These are definitely contributors to the larger problem.
And Brad, I mentioned invasive species often contribute to the extinction of other species. How big a problem is that?
That's a major problem, and this report definitely highlights that. And it's not only, you know, a single or even multiple invasive organisms that can displace native species. It's multiple stressors. So we have the stress of climate change and, you know, fragmentation and pollution. And then you couple that with the introduction of a brand new species that does not have predators, for instance, and is able to outcompete native species. And all these multiple stressors, like this report illustrates, have really serious consequences for biodiversity.
Talking to Brad Herrick with UW-Madison Arboretum and Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, looking at invasive species. A new United Nations-backed report puts a huge multi-billion-dollar annual price tag on them. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with an invasive species in your own backyard. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carol, the report named the most widespread invasive animal in the world, the black rat, the most widespread invasive plant in the world, the water hyacinth. What is it, and Brad started to touch on this, what is it that makes some species so successful when they're introduced to a new and different environment?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. This is multifaceted. There's usually not just one factor, but multiple factors. So there are extrinsic factors like the environmental conditions that enable them to invade, and also intrinsic properties, such as the traits that a population might have or an individual organism might have, or their genetic composition, such as how much genetic variation there is in the population. So if there's sufficient genetic variation, if there's something about the novel habitat, like lack of predators, lack of competitors, those are factors that would contribute. So there's multiple factors that enable a population to become invasive. One thing I want to emphasize is that not all introduced populations become invasive. There's a subset that do, and that subset tends to be either really good at spreading or they're really good at evolving to adapt to novel conditions. So there's a series of different factors involved.
Brad, you've been on the show in the past talking about one invasive species we have here in Wisconsin, a kind of jumping worm. Can you tell us a little bit about the history and impact?
Right. So this is a relatively new invader to North America, at least in terms of its spread. It was introduced a while ago into a couple of different states, but the last 15, 20 years, it's really spread. And the Arboretum here on campus at the University of Wisconsin was the first record in the state of this invasive earthworm. And basically the concern is that these earthworms, like all earthworms do, they consume vast amounts of organic matter. So whether that's leaves that have fallen on the forest floor or compost and mulch that you put down on your garden, they consume it so rapidly that it depletes nutrients that are really important for plant growth. It causes soil erosion because there's nothing able to hold the soil in place in terms of like the plant roots. And we're seeing now they're spreading throughout the United States, into Canada, they're in Mexico. And so they are, in some sense, a generalist invader, invading multiple climates and habitats. And so it's one that is relatively new, and it follows a previous earthworm invasion. And some people don't appreciate that in Wisconsin and upper Midwest, all earthworms are non-native. And many of them are invasive. So like the common nightcrawler, one that's very popular with fishing and gardening, is considered invasive. And so we have sort of a second wave now of earthworms coming in that are really fundamentally different from that first wave. And so we're just sort of catching up now in terms of research, learning about the potential impacts.
And Carol, what species in our waterways do you have your eyes on?
Well, my laboratory has worked on zebra mussels, quagga mussels, and invasive plankton. So one thing that people often don't think about is with ballast water dumping, tons and tons and tons of planktonic species are being dumped into the waterways. So I'm interested in a lot of those crustacean plankton species that are also being introduced in massive scales. So Great Lakes invasions is especially what I'm interested in. I'm also looking at invaders in Europe and invaders all over the world, but mainly aquatic invaders is what I have my eyes on.
And how do those zebra mussels and others, and we've talked about them on the show before, what kind of impact are they having on our freshwater waterways in the state?
Well, you can probably see them. Anyone who's gone to the shoreline can see them taking over. They not only, they're filter suspension feeders. So they eat up all the plankton, planktonic algae that are in the water, making them unavailable for other species. So the water might look clean, but they're also taking out a lot of the food from the waterways that other populations or species might want to consume. They're also displacing a lot of native mussels, like uniodon mussels, which are slower growing. They're also encrusting any physical structure. So they're physically altering the habitat by growing over anything. So without an abundance of natural predators, they're just kind of taking over in terms of population growth. So the zebra mussels invaded first, and now the quagga mussels are taking over. And that's a common pattern that's also happening in Europe and in other locations. Usually the zebra mussel is a faster invader. Ultimately, the quagga mussel takes over and becomes more of a problem in the long run.
We're talking about a new United Nations-backed report on the global impact of invasive species. Carol Lee is with us, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, and Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, solutions, possible solutions. What do you want to see done to address the invasive species problem globally and maybe in your own backyard? Do you think non-native plant and animal species need more controls on them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, and Brad Herrick, ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum, looking at a new report finding that invasive species cost over $400 billion globally each year and cause massive environmental destruction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mary is with us in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
Well, I have sort of a question, but I guess I'm asking more for comments or information from the guests. Where invasive species are considered, I'm wondering about the definition and whether there's an expiration date on that. And I'll give you the example that's bringing this to mind for me. I have heard for a good while and heard repeated again of Australian dingoes called an invasive species. And there have been in my lifetime, and I'm not that old, plenty of initiatives where thousands upon thousands of dingoes were hunted down and killed in Australia. I think of that animal as being pretty quintessentially Australian, and it turns out there's pretty good reason for that. They've been there for thousands of years.
Mary, I gotcha. Carol, is there a definition where we might say, okay, it wasn't there originally, maybe it came over with humans, as I believe the dingo did in Australia, but after a few millennia, it gets to count as part of the local landscape?
Well, I think we need to think about the context for invasive populations. It is true that some populations become naturalized. For instance, if you look at the work of Bernd Blossi at Cornell University, the garlic mustard on the East Coast has been there a lot longer than in the Midwest. So garlic mustard is highly invasive in the Midwest, but on the East Coast, it's becoming naturalized. Over decades, it has evolved to become less invasive. And the natural populations, the competitors, have evolved to be able to compete with the garlic mustard. So there is an evolutionary context. So over time, an invasive population can become naturalized if we let the native populations evolve, either to prey upon the species, native pathogens to infect this invader, or native species to compete with them. So there is some kind of, as the caller said, expiration date when they're no longer invasive, but this is a long time period. And we do need, when the invader comes in, we do need to protect the native species so that they could evolve in response to the invader and not get extirpated, not go extinct. Mary. I'm wondering if that answers the question.
Sure. Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Before we go back to our callers, Brad, I want to start to touch on some solutions. When we have a species like, say, a jumping worm, what are some of the things we either maybe could have done to prevent it showing up or to turn it back once it's here?
Well, in terms of most invasive species, it like Carol alluded to, it really depends on the context. It depends on, you know, how early an invasive species is identified and if there are controls that are readily available. You know, the first thing when it comes to, you know, whether it's jumping worms or any invasive species, is education. It really, and, you know, having folks understand what the species looks like, what it is, where to find it, what its potential impacts are, and really, explaining why it's potentially problematic that we have these species. And then you sort of gain trust and you get some some buy-in into helping to control. Prevention is, like in the medical industry, prevention is the best medicine when it comes to invasive species. It's by far the most cost-effective. There are, depending on the species and the context, there are, some technologies that are being developed to deal with some invasive species. There are controls, depending on the context, but those are really labor intensive often and sometimes cost prohibitive. And so, prevention, education, slowing the spread, that's really where it starts.
Let's go back to our callers. Yes. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. In my previous employer and where I work now, we've gone through some quite extreme measures for controlling quagga mussels and zebra mussels, namely through chemical injection. And at my previous employer, it kind of came on to us rather rapidly. And by the time we realized we had a zebra mussel problem. They were already causing some pretty catastrophic consequences in our cooling water systems at my employer. And that's what I wanted to bring up.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. And Carol, that goes, I think, right to your interest there. Once we have zebra mussels and quagga mussels, what can we do about them?
That's a really difficult problem. There's many different methods that have been proposed, like chemical methods, mechanical removal, thermal treatment, UV light, low frequency magnetism. Somebody also wanted to introduce bacteria. There was a scientist that called me once. He wanted to look at the experiments I was doing and wanted to test using a pathogen bacteria. And I was not particularly keen on that because we don't know what effect that pathogen would have on other Great Lakes species. There's people that want to introduce serotonin to affect the physiology of the organisms. I think there are a variety of methods that are proposed. I do think that it is important to clamp down on them to reduce their numbers so that the native populations can survive and eventually evolve in response to them. I do think we need to be careful about some of the solutions and methods because that can introduce a whole nother can of worms. For instance, introducing a pathogen could kill off other native populations. Introducing chemicals could also be problematic. So I think very rigorous testing is required. There are a variety of methods out there. I like the mechanical method, but we do need to reduce their numbers to allow some native populations, native species to survive and not go extinct. We do need to be careful about the methods we're using and think carefully about their consequences.
I want to ask each of you, thanks again for that call, Mark. I want to ask each of you for maybe a couple items from your wish list, policy changes you might like to see made that would help prevent the spread of invasive species and help support the native species. Brad, let's start with you.
That's a big question.
Yes.
I think it starts with federal funding to really, be able to inspect the borders in a way that can clamp down on some, especially some of these newer ones, or newer invasive species. So it, and even at the state level, we have a great Department of Natural Resources that have regulations in place for invasive species, but very little enforcement ability, just given the scale. And so funding to come up with education, prevention ideas, new technologies, but really at the border, preventing the introduction of new species. So we have our hands full with the ones that are already here.
And Carol, if I could zoom in on one you're working on, I believe in your own yard. You think we could have some policies that might help our native plant species in particular?
Yes, I have a pretty long wish list, but I'm only going to name a few things. I think we really need to regulate, and some people hate the word regulation, but we really need to regulate the horticulture and aquarium industries. For instance, you could go online and order the worst invader in our local habitat and plant it in your yard. And our own gardens are a huge source of novel invaders. So we need to fundamentally rethink and change how we garden, as I mentioned earlier. And we should encourage the planting of native species. For instance, our highways. When I was living in California, they were planting invasive Australian ice plants along the highway, one of the terrible invaders there. So even our government systems, our institutions should be encouraged to plant native species. I mean, and we should fundamentally rethink what we think is beautiful. Why is the Kentucky invasive bluegrass the default beautiful thing that we plant in our lawns? Why are we planting invasive species, all these lawn plants, when we could actually regard our native prairies as beautiful, which will support native insects and other native populations? So we need to rethink what we consider beautiful and really promote our native populations. And we need to let areas go wild. Disturbance is something that promotes invasive populations to enter new habitats. Instead of you know, constantly turning over and disturbing habitats. We should let certain areas just, you know, go wild and leave.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guests, Carol Lee and Brad Herrick, with us for a look at invasive species in Wisconsin and beyond. It's a cliche for pet owners. Open that can of tuna and cats will come running looking for their delicious treat. Over the years, people have wondered why, pointing out the cats evolved from ancestors in deserts where the tuna do not roam wild and free. A new study finds it's all in the chemistry. Research in the journal Chemical Sense, written up in Live Science, looks at the taste receptors of cats. Cats are like us in one way. They have receptors for a flavor profile called umami. We get that in things like mushrooms, meats, fish, and more. But cats have some umami receptors that we don't that bind to two chemicals that are found in very high concentrations in tuna. So if you like eating tuna, imagine that you had a special power in your taste buds that made you like it even more. That's what cats are tasting. Bonus fact, apparently the taste receptors for sweet flavors are turned off in cats. They neither love nor hate sweet flavors. I don't know about you, I could go for some tuna right now. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.